Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody from Wondery. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. Thanks for hanging out with me today. So one of the really consistent things that happens as you throw yourself into a new subject is that you realize just how much you don't know, how many vast topics are out there that are totally new and mind-blowing. That's how I felt over the past couple of months as we've started to dig into the cultures of the ancient Middle East. It's a whole new world of cities, art, politics, and literature about which I previously knew almost nothing. At the heart of this world was a writing system, cuneiform. Cuneiform was incredibly durable, long-lasting, and influential, but for those of us brought up in educational traditions focused on Europe, it's probably not something we know too much about. Maybe we read the Epic of Gilgamesh, if that, or learn a few names of kings like Sargon or Hammurabi, or maybe, if you're getting real wild with it, Ashurbanipal. That's a shame, because cuneiform literature is much more than Gilgamesh or the deeds of kings. It's an incredible window onto a segment of the past in space and time that we're just not exposed to nearly enough. Luckily, we've got a great guest here today who can help us understand the cuneiform world. She's a postdoctoral researcher at Wolfson College at the University of Oxford, where she earned her PhD in Oriental Studies. She's an Assyriologist and an expert in cuneiform literature, especially cuneiform medical and scientific texts, and a perpetually fascinating person to follow on Twitter. We couldn't ask for a better guide to cuneiform culture. Dr. Moody Al-Rashid, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me talk about my favorite subject in the world, cuneiform.
So let's start with the basics here. What defines cuneiform as a writing system? So like when we're talking about a literate cuneiform culture, where is that in time and space?
So I think one way to talk about cuneiform is to talk about its relationship to the landscape. So as you said, cuneiform is a writing system, and it was in use in a region that we call Mesopotamian English, which actually comes from the Greek between the rivers, referring to the Tigris and Euphrates. It basically covers what is now Iraq and Syria, although the use of cuneiform did sort of spill out into neighboring regions and countries due to various socio-political factors in different periods. Now, the landscape in southern Iraq at the time of the development of cuneiform near the end of the 4th millennium BCE was like a rich alluvial plain, which is just a fancy way of saying an area with deposits of clay, silt, sand, things that make the land very fertile. But sort of primary among this is the clay. So along these rivers, you have these rich deposits of clay, and you also have reed beds. These features of the landscape help explain the medium of the writing system that developed in this area, which uses clay that is impressed or traced in the early phases with a reed stylus. It gets its name in English from the Latin cuneus, which means wedge. I don't actually know Latin. I'm just kind of regurgitating what I've been told about it. but I do know that in Arabic, it's called al-kitabat al-mismariya, which I think comes from the word mismar, which means nail. So interestingly, in both English and Arabic, the word for this writing system has something to do with the way it looks. And it is very distinctive visually. It's a very interesting writing system. There are about 1,000 signs or characters, whatever sort of word you want to use for that. Some of these are logograms, which means they represent whole words. Some are syllabograms, which means they represent syllables. So the word syllable would be written as, instead of syllable, it would be written something like syllable, with three signs that stand for those three sounds. And some of these signs are what we call determinatives, which is a kind of sign that precedes or follows a word to tell you how to read it. So the divine determinative, which precedes the name of a goddess or god, looks like a star. And that signals, okay, the thing that's going to follow is the name of a god or a goddess. Another interesting feature of cuneiform is that it's multivalent, which is a way of saying that each sign has multiple values. This makes it very confusing, but it also sort of opens up this whole world of scholarship that you find in cuneiform texts that relies on these multiple levels of meaning. So going back to the question of how it's bounded in time and space. So Mesopotamia, again, we're talking about a region, not a civilization. And as you said, the common denominator of the various civilizations that rose and fell in this region was that they used cuneiform for about 3,000 years. So the earliest sort of proto-cuneiform comes from around 3300 BCE, and the very last cuneiform text that's datable is from 79 CE. And both, interestingly, come from Uruk. So the earliest writings developed in Uruk and the last datable cuneiform tablet, which is an astronomical almanac, is also from Uruk. And this kind of writing technology is what connected the inhabitants with a shared way of making sense of the world, of organizing and managing the world. And this is what we call cuneiform culture. And it survives in the form of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of texts that allow us to reconstruct a lot of the history.
Three 3,000 years of usage of a writing system is an incredibly long period of time. That's longer than the Latin alphabet has been in use in the present day. Hundreds of thousands of texts. I mean, that's a huge number of things from a very wide range in time. So if it has logograms, syllabograms, it has determinatives. The earliest cuneiform texts were written in the Sumerian language. Is that correct?
So yes and no, which I can elaborate on.
Okay, so the earliest texts are written in are yes and no written in Sumerian. But what other languages was cuneiform used for?
So I'll start with the yes and no bit because it's a very interesting question. It goes back to how cuneiform developed as a writing system. So writing and agriculture were very much intertwined. And in fact, actually, there's a goddess of writing, Nidaba or Nisaba, who's also the goddess of grain because of how closely related the two were. To paint a very oversimplified picture of what happened, essentially what you have is this fertile soil in southern Iraq, and a lot of irrigation technologies were developed to sort of tame the landscape in a way that allowed for the rise of surplus agriculture. In other words, there was enough food to feed everybody. In fact, there was so much that they needed a way of recording information about what was going on agriculturally. And this gave rise to the use of initially mnemonic devices to keep track of that kind of information. So the earliest mnemonic devices may have taken the form of tokens, but eventually the medium for carrying this information becomes clay tablets. However, the earliest ones of these may be independent of language. So there's not a one-to-one relationship between the stuff on the tablets and any kind of like linguistic information. They were just drawings of things and numerical notations to help people keep track of information. But let's say if you saw one of the tablets and I saw one of them, we could have read them differently, even if we could retrieve the same information from them.
So basically, they're recording information, but there's no underlying like linguistic value to them. So if you see a sign for grain, you know that's grain. You don't need to know the word for grain in any particular language to know that's what it is.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And so we call this proto-cuneiform in the field. And eventually, this becomes cuneiform. Again, this is a very broad brush that I'm painting this rather complex development with. And that is Sumerian. That is recording the Sumerian language. And we have hints of Sumerian in signs that give grammatical information, essentially. And again, all of these come from a city called Uruk and nearby Jamdet Nasr. Those are where the earliest texts come from. But as you said, cuneiform as a writing system was used to record quite a few different languages. So initially Sumerian, and then it was adapted to record a completely unrelated language, which was Akkadian. Sumerian is what we call a language isolate in the field, in that it's not related to any known language that we can discern so far. Whereas Akkadian is. It's part of the Semitic language family, and it's the earliest known Semitic language. So even though the languages were very different, the writing system was still used to write both. And it was in fact adapted then to write quite a few other languages in use in the ancient Middle East, notably Hittite, which is actually an Indo-European language, as well as Ugaritic, another Semitic language, but cuneiform was actually adapted into an alphabet, a cuneiform alphabet to write Ugaritic, interestingly, Eblai, and a few others in the ancient Middle East. And it was used to write all kinds of texts. So even though it initially is developed to record stuff going on administratively in a kind of agricultural setting, it ends up being used to write everything from diplomatic correspondence to, you know, lullabies and receipts for doing laundry.
Fascinating. So we have this really, really flexible writing system that's suited to this kind of cosmopolitan, multicultural, multilingual world, because there's this assumption in the present day that you have kind of the boundaries of a polity, and within that polity, people speak a language, and that's the language that people are taught. But that's not a very good match for most of human history, and especially not for the ancient world, where you have lots and lots of speech communities that overlap. You have lots of multilingualism. You have lots of kind of fluid boundaries between places. The boundaries of an archaeological culture and a polity and a speech community don't necessarily line up in any specific way. Cuneiform seems to be really well suited to serve as a written medium in that kind of environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually really, I think, really important point. And you even have that kind of diversity in ancient Mesopotamia throughout the various periods. One thing that is limiting about cuneiform, though, is that it was recorded on clay, which survived. I mean, it's literally just a very durable substance. But there were probably, you know, other types of sources that didn't. We know for sure there were writing boards, for example, that were used in quite restricted settings, but still those may have recorded another, you know, possibly Aramaic, for example. And focusing on cuneiform text does narrow things a little bit, but there are so many, it still tells us quite a lot about the region and its history.
A major question about cuneiform culture and about written texts as a whole is that they never tell us about society as a whole. They're never representative of everybody because not everybody in the ancient world can write. So who were the people who were writing cuneiform texts? And you mentioned a whole variety of purposes, but what kind of things were they using them for?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a very big question. and a very important point that you make about sort of the limitations of what we, based on who's writing them and what the context of that was. And there are so many things that we'll never know, you know, entire segments of society we can only know so much about, because those people either didn't have access to this technology or to those trained in it, or because those who did have access were writing about them in a certain way. So at its most basic, cuneiform and cuneiform writing was available to those trained as scribes. This is like the most kind of general way to answer this question. But they were trained to do different things. So there was a kind of a basic scribal curriculum that isn't, you know, uniform throughout ancient Mesopotamia, but there were sort of shared elements that prepared someone to learn cuneiform. And then you sort of specialize, kind of like how education works today in some settings. So some people went on to do sort of legal and administrative type of texts, everything from sort of contracts to receipts to letters. Others specialized in scholarly disciplines like medicine or astronomy or lamentations or incantations, that sort of thing. And their job was to sort of copy and edit those types of texts that belong within their discipline. But this is then further complicated by the question of authorship. Some of them will, in the scholarly curriculum, will be signed by someone. There'll be a colophon or like a signature section at the end of the tablet. But that person didn't necessarily compose the text. They're just kind of copying an earlier version of it that somebody else composed. So this then gives rise to additional questions about who wrote cuneiform, because we know who literally copied the text, but we don't know who composed the originals. So getting a bit more granular, literacy varied then from period to period. I think a really good example is the Old Assyrian period, which is around 2000 BCE to 1600 BCE. And during that period, the Assyrian Empire had a vast trade network that reached well into sort of what is now Turkey. This necessitated, in some cases, the breakup of households, where, for example, a husband might be based in Kanish, up in Turkey, kind of trading, important trade post, and a wife would remain in Ashur, the capital of the Assyrian heartland, to run the household and business interests there, as to safeguard goods and archives, etc. Those people weren't trained as scribes, but they needed to learn a kind of basic repertoire of signs to keep in touch with each other and update each other and make requests and fulfill requests. Interestingly, this included women. So, for example, there's a woman called Lamasi who writes quite a few letters to her husband about challenges with getting wool or not being paid for certain things. And some of them get, you know, quite heated. Another woman writes, called Shimatsuin, writes a letter where she describes waiting for a payment for textiles that she sent to someone, that she was then going to use that payment to pay off a debt. So this tells a little bit about the kind of landscape of business and who could be involved in it, as well as who was writing texts. There are also some wonderful letters from the Old Assyrian period about smuggling and tax evasion, which is just another sort of reminder.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly.
So that's really interesting. So you have a class of professional scribe. That's their job. Your job is to serve as the person who's writing this stuff down. But then there's also a kind of a broader literate culture that goes along with that. It's really interesting that, I mean, like, throughout time and space, writing isn't always treated the same as a skill or a technology, right? Like, so in medieval Europe, there's a great text from the abbot of a monastery where he's talking about training the monks to do various things. And he's like, we take the really dull boys and we make them scribes because it's basically just like manual labor that you're just kind of copying texts. But in other times and places, the ability to write something can be quite high status. At other points, it's just kind of like, just kind of a job, just kind of a thing that people do. So where on that kind of spectrum from high status activity down to we take the dull boys and we make them scribes, would scribal culture be in cuneiform culture?
I mean, if you're talking about sort of the scholarly element of scribal culture, it would definitely be the higher sort of end of that spectrum. It was a kind of quite a narrow group of people that was carrying this out. It did include some women. I mean, mostly by and large men. But for example, there are a handful of disciplines, amongst them medical professionals, and there are a few references to women physicians or women exorcists, another type of medical professional. But by and large, they were men, and by and large, they carried out their scholarship in certain periods for the sake of helping the king sort of run the empire. So a really good example of this is the Neo-Assyrian period, where you have the library of Ashurbanipal that is quite, you know, becoming more and more famous, I hope, at least I like to think. And so even though it's sort of a modern construct and it's not as simple as just a single library that belonged to a king, it has its own sort of historiography. The types of texts the king Ashurbanipal was concerned with and the types of scholars he surrounded himself with that sort of went with those, the production of those texts, helped him run the empire. And this included things like diviners or seers, however you want to translate that term, because they helped with decision making. And it was a legitimate discipline of scholarship that helped people make decisions. You know, there were also physicians to help with health issues, astronomers and astrologers to help read the signs in the sky, and also then help King Ashurbanipal make decisions. So it's a fairly elite kind of group. At the same time, you read these letters from scholars to kings, and you do have a very human element in a lot of them. So, for example, some of them will write, and I can't remember his name, but there's one that's just like, will I ever get a day off? And then there are others that are like, no one is paying me. You know, I'm dying of anxiety here, you know, and he literally says, I'm dying of a broken heart because sort of being neglected on the payroll or people being expelled from the court. So there is a very human element to all this, despite the kind of narrow segment of society involved.
I can't stop thinking as you're talking about this, the kinds of scholars that the king surrounds himself with. I can't stop thinking of like scholars at a think tank where, they're just diviners trying to understand the world and give a little bit of insight and always worried about where the next paycheck's coming from. Like, if that's not kind of a constant in the life of a scholar, I don't know what is. Like, is the check actually gonna come? Or am I gonna get paid this
month? Very relatable.
Again, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
So I want to come back to, you talked about business, and I love economic history. I'm really fascinated by this. So that gives us some pretty direct insights into how people were trading and doing business in that particular period, that you've got widespread trade networks. You've got a variety of people within a household who are kind of doing various functions with regard to economic activities. And writing is the medium that allows you to conduct business over space. I mean, that's not that common a thing in the grand scheme of the pre-modern world. To have a kind of a written literate business culture is not something we should take for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love about those, especially for the Old Assyrian period, what I love about those texts is that they're very human. Like, you can see these families that are sort of separated by these vast distances, that are just trying, they're doing their best. They're like complaining to each other about like, why haven't I heard from you about this particular question I've asked you like three times, or, you know, they're just saying, giving instructions to each other about how to run things. You get sort of intimate details about how people did things, both practically, but also within kind of domestic spheres. And it's just, yeah, it's an amazing window that we have as people today onto people back then that just, again, reminds us, as you said, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
So, okay, I want to come back to the issue of what languages were being written. We talked about Sumerian. You mentioned Akkadian. That's what a lot of your work is focused on. So what's Akkadian? What other languages is it related to?
Absolutely love Akkadian. So Akkadian is, as I mentioned, it's a Semitic language. It's the earliest known written Semitic language, but it's an East Semitic language. So the vast, vast, vast majority of Semitic languages that we know of are West Semitic languages. And Akkadian is an East Semitic language. It's a very formal linguistic label, but it's an important distinction. But there is a lot of overlap with modern Semitic languages. So I speak Arabic, and there's a lot of vocabulary that's sort of shared between the two, whether they have a common sort of great-great-great-grand ancestor in the form of a proto-Semitic language, or they've been loaned or otherwise made their way. But things like beit is bait in Arabic, which means house, and akhu is brother. It's the same in Arabic. Shamshu is sun. So there's a lot of, you know, perhaps, you know, speakers of Semitic languages that tune into your podcast might recognize some of those as well. And I don't know modern Assyrian, but I understand there's a ton of shared vocabulary with Akkadian, as well as the survival of some very ancient names. So an example I recently encountered is Nabu, who was the god of writing. So we talked about Nidabar Nisaba as the goddess of writing. Nabu is a god of writing who's very important, actually, in the Neo-Assyrian period. I believe becomes the name Nebo. So there's the survival of a lot of, you know, not just the culture, but a lot of features of the language into today's Semitic languages. But back to the ancient world, there are broadly two main dialects of Akkadian. This is a kind of traditional view that is open to revision. And those are, we know as Babylonian and Assyrian. Confusingly, also the names of the civilizations and the time periods. Okay. but there's also this kind of third literary dialect that is an invention of scholars that has some of these Assyrian and Babylonian dialectical features in it, but that it was basically just used for scholarly and in particular literary texts. And we call it today Standard Babylonian. So there are a couple of very important dialects that, you know, are very well attested in the surviving cuneiform texts. So I specialize in the first millennium BCE. So all the texts I look at or teach are in Akkadian. And specifically, much of the scientific corpus is written in Akkadian. Not tons of sort of medical texts in Sumerian. I actually only know of a handful. And similarly with astronomical texts. So Akkadian is sort of the language of science, if we're happy to use that label, which I'm very happy to use that label.
Okay, you mentioned your particular interests are in kind of this medical and scientific literature. Those texts are from the first millennium BCE. What was their audience and what kinds of texts are we talking about? Like, when we talk about kind of a medical and a scientific corpus, what did they consider a medical and scientific stuff? Like, what were they interested in? What are they into?
Yeah, so they're actually quite well-defined medical texts and astronomical texts, which I'm going to just treat as the two disciplines of science for now. Otherwise, it gets a little bit too big of a topic. And if we look at medicine first, they would have been used, copied, relied upon by medical professionals, in particular therapeutic texts, so texts that give instructions for how to treat an illness to whoever could afford or access that kind of treatment. And in fact, some of the texts show quite a lot of of revision and experimentation. There's even this label in Akkadian, the word, the verb is lataku, to test. And so a lot of remedies are, in the first millennium BC, are labeled as tested. This has been tested. It is known to work, that sort of thing. So we know a lot of these things were actually used in practice. And in terms of sort of the audience, I guess in that sense, you could say for the medical text, the audience really is just the medical professionals that are using them, and for the purpose of healing non-medical professionals. In terms of the astronomical texts, it's a little bit different because the audience can include people like royalty, for example. So we have tons of astrological reports that have survived from the Neo-Assyrian period in which astronomers or astrologers, or whatever you want to call them, I think Dr. Willis Munroe's, I feel like I quote him in everything I do, his solution is to just call it astronomology. So combine the two together because they really are, you know, inseparable for this period. And they make their reports to the king. So it really depends on the type of text that you're talking about, the purpose of it, and again, what it's going to be used for, who's going to rely on it, and to what end.
Okay, so that's really, really fascinating. So you have a body of medical professionals who have a body of written knowledge that circulates between them about remedies for common ailments. They have a common vocabulary, a common sense for what these ailments are, how to treat them. That's absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that there was that kind of a medical culture.
Yeah, and just to kind of even go into a bit more detail, there are different kinds of medical professionals, and I'll give the accepted translation. So the asu is the physician, and the ashipu is the exorcist. It's a really problematic translation because it makes it sound like they're not doing medicine when they actually are, because the quote-unquote supernatural causes were built into the natural world. So something like a demon who is an agent of a particular type of disease is real as a snake that bites you. So both of these kind of types of agents of disease are worthy of treatment by these different kinds of medical professionals. There's a lot of overlap. So for example, there are sometimes exorcists who will copy tablets that are meant for an asu, for a physician, and they will use those types of remedies, and vice versa. So, and there must have also been quite a bit of competition between the two types of medical professionals. So it can get quite specific, actually, depending on the type of medical professional that you're looking at. And the reason for these two is that, I mean, there are many ways to conceptualize illness in different societies. And in ancient Mesopotamia, in general, again, speaking very generally, there were a few different levels of causation for a disease that then mirror these professions. So there's the natural cause, like, for example, let's say a snake bite. And there's a supernatural layer to, you know, almost every type of ailment. And the exorcist is focused on that, whereas the asu is sort of focused on the natural cause. And then behind all of this, there is the, well, what did I do wrong? Like, what taboo did I commit that invited this misfortune on me? So the text types and the professional types kind of mirror this view of disease and illness more generally, which I think is really quite interesting. And we can learn so much from them.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. And I think there is a tendency in the present day to treat medical knowledge as if it's kind of a direct reflection of the natural world and of the natural causes for a thing, which is not actually how people engage with disease. It's not actually how we understand disease, even among medical professionals. Like, you've got your diagnostic manuals, but those things are constantly shifting. Our understanding of the causes of disease are constantly shifting. I mean, like, I've been doing physical therapy for long enough to know that there are treatments that come in and out of fashion based on new developments and discoveries, and what was established 10 years ago is now frowned upon. And so, like, you can have medical cultures that understand the same disease in dramatically different ways that may not necessarily be any more or less appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's so interesting about the history of medicine. You have this shared kind of subject, which is the human body, which hasn't changed that much between, you know, now and 4,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago and today. But you have a totally different way of conceptualizing it, its relationship to the world, and how to kind of address problems that arise and how to frame them as well, because hearing a voice it might not be a bad thing in every society, might not be a symptom, might actually be quite a gift. A lot of my research looks at mental symptoms and mental illness. And I think, you know, that in particular is a very interesting way into how people understood the world, understood their place in the world, understood what was considered normal, what disrupted your relationship with the community or with yourself or with others. And I think the history of medicine is a really interesting window onto that.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
I want to come back to issues of mental illness in just a second. Before that, there's a really fascinating discussion that happened in the historiography of medieval Europe about 25 or 30 years ago that had to do with fasting. And there was an article that came out where a guy was like, okay, well, this behavior that female saints engaged in regularly that was kind of extreme fasting, well, they were just anorexic. But anorexia is not something that means the same thing in every context. And for these particular people in this particular context, it was very much a sign of sanctity. It was not an eating disorder. It was about their relationship to the divine and what they were willing to do to enhance their connection to the divine. So you can have exactly the same set of symptoms or behaviors that are just understood in dramatically different ways depending on the context.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very interesting example. I didn't know that. But precisely, and that's why I think the history of medicine is just so interesting.
I want to come back to mental distress and depression, because again, this is a thing where even in the present day, we can see understandings of mental illness and depression dramatically changing from year to year. How did the authors of the texts that you're working with, and presumably people around them, how did they understand mental distress and depression?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the difficulties of doing any kind of like history of psychology, psychiatry, mental illness, mental symptoms is exactly as you said, even today, the definition of various illnesses are constantly in flux and being regrouped, and symptoms are being organized in certain ways. And so it's impossible to project that back onto the ancient world. So I think the first thing I did when I started my research was dispense with that altogether and look instead at, even if I'm not identifying illnesses, what symptoms did they identify that they may have organized into different types of illnesses or into illnesses in a way that's different from the way we organize them into illnesses. And certainly they have descriptions of depression and dejected states. These are often linked to other descriptions of mental states, such as fear, anxiety. There's a term that translates almost exactly to breaking of the heart. So heartbreak can be a kind of a sensation in the stomach, perhaps, that's associated with anxiety, or in the chest. But either way, I think it reflects a type of anxiety. But alongside the sort of spectrum of moods and terminology for mental states, you also have physiological symptoms that are often grouped with these mental symptoms. So things that may sound familiar to anyone who's suffered from, for example, depression. So I had pretty bad depression when I was at university, and I used to take medication for it. And one of the things I suffered from a lot was my stomach hurt all the time. I had a sort of a nervous stomach, and I never had an appetite. So you do have descriptions of loss of appetite, of someone bringing the wording is that your heart's desire is brought to you as in, you know, the food that you really like, and they just sort of, oh God, I don't want that, you know. Difficulty sleeping, problems with libido. It can get quite graphic, actually, in some of these therapeutic texts that describe mental symptoms and illness. So the way they group these things together, they seem to favor including physiological, sometimes called somatic symptoms, together with, you know, mental or psychological descriptions. So depression, lowercase d, is a topic that comes up quite a lot in the medical texts I look at. And the way it's organized, I think, is really interesting. I sometimes wonder if it was grouped physical symptoms because they didn't have the sort of dualism that we have inherited from early modern philosophy. And B, because it's easier to treat difficulty sleeping or loss of appetite, maybe, than something that you can't quite see like sadness. That's just a totally, speculative comment that I'm making. But what I think is important is that they treated these experiences as valid medical concerns. There was no sort of stigmatization of them. A person could go to an ASU or an ASHIPU with these experiences and say, I need medical treatment for it. It's not a modern invention. And I think that's really an important takeaway for me anyway from these texts. They suffer the same things back then that we do today.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. I'm really fascinated by the grouping of the physical and the mental symptoms together, because we know, like, your mind has such a powerful effect on your body that this dualism is an inherently flawed kind of thing, an inherently flawed perspective to take, that, like, having physical symptoms that go along with depression is incredibly common. I mean, like, that's not at all an uncommon thing. So it's fascinating to me that they had figured that out, something that could have been forgotten in the interim, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the brain is also part of this whole picture, and that's a physical thing. I totally agree. I was talking to a neurologist about this a couple of years ago, and, you know, we were talking about this kind of move back toward the physicality of the mental in a way. And I think that's a really interesting kind of point to draw out of these texts.
So do you get any sense for how they conceptualized emotion? Because we know, again, that emotion is a thing that's going to be fairly culturally specific in the way that it's understood and categorized and kind of the boundaries on its expression. Do we get any sense for that from these medical texts as well? Like, is there a sense for what's too much emotion or what is an inappropriate emotion to feel that's kind of medicalized?
Well, I think in a way you could answer by saying anything that made it into the medical text is probably already either chronic or extreme, or something about it is not matching up to what would be considered in that context, like a normal, in quotation mark, response to things happening around you. Or it could be that these are, you know, normal responses to distress or misfortune, but that there was an available way to treat it. So I think there are two ways to think about that angle. But I think there's also a lot of clues about emotion and the history of emotions in non-medical texts. So, for example, this expression heartbreak appears also in a kind of verbal construction in the Old Babylonians. So Old Babylonians, the period 2000 BCE to 1600 BCE, in the Old Babylonian version of the flood epic, where the kind of Noah figure, whose name is Atrahasis, realizes sort of on the eve of the flood that he's going to have to leave behind, you know, everyone. And I think the line reads something like, his heart breaks and he vomits gall. So we have descriptions of emotion in all kinds of contexts, both extreme, normal, and, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh is another excellent example. You know, his response to the death of Enkidu is, you know, is very moving, and is, you know, anyone who's lost someone can see themselves in this, in his just sheer, you know, loss and distress. So there are hints at that in all kinds of texts. And I think, you know, the medical texts are a very interesting window onto that. But there are just so many, you know, even letters, there's so many sources that can also supplement that picture.
Yeah, I'm really struck in the way that you discuss this by the intersection between the universal experience of being human in a body and the culturally specific manifestations of how we understand that. Like, that's just really striking to me.
Yeah, and I mean, and to me, that's what the history of science is in general. And that's why I love doing the history of science. It's a history of how people made sense of stuff. And the way they make sense of things fits with a particular context or a particular way of understanding the world. And there was a bit circular. But I mean, what I find so interesting is that this constant endeavor to make sense and make the world, which is chaos, something ordered and something manageable or intelligible, is this, you know, it's for quite a human drive. And I think the history of that is really, it's just so interesting.
So what drew you to the study of cuneiform in general?
The short answer is Irving Finkel. As one does, I took a summer class for fun on the book in the ancient world. Perfectly normal thing to do when you're in your mid-20s. And the first day was taught by Dr. Irving Finkel of the British Museum. And he was so animated about it. And I mean, his window onto cuneiform really sparked my interest, to the point where instead of applying to law schools that summer, I applied to Oxford to do cuneiform studies because it was the only place still taking applications and miraculously got in. So it was a really, you know, gut feeling that I just went with. Yeah, it was at completely random. It changed the course of my life, that one and a half days in that summer of, you know, whatever it was, 2008. So that's what got me into cuneiform. I just fell in love. I fell in love with the ancient language. I fell in love with just the sheer quantity of sources and how much they can tell us, how much they tell us about people back then and how much we have in common with them, really.
I mean, when you know, you know, as they say.
Exactly.
I mean, so this is, I don't think I had any idea that the corpus of cuneiform literature was as large as it is. I mean, hundreds of thousands of texts. I don't know what I thought, but I definitely don't think I thought it was that many.
Yeah, I mean, it's so many. And then, well, there are a couple of really interesting projects and important projects in the field to digitize those tablets. And I mean, it's just such an epic undertaking because there are hundreds of thousands of these texts, and they're everything from like administrative receipts to royal inscriptions, hymns, prayers, astronomical tablets, an approximation of pi, proverb, records of litigation, you know, how far Jupiter went across the sky using complex geometry. I mean, it's just such an incredible corpus that has survived from ancient Mesopotamia.
One of the things that has been intensely frustrating to me over the course of my career as a historian is just that, like, the effort that people will put into studying the same text over and over and over again, because that's the text that speaks to a particular area, or that's the one historian who survives from early medieval England or from Francia or what have you. And so you get these incredibly long, detailed studies of this. It's just like there are so many other texts in other places. There's other bodies of evidence that you could be studying. Like, instead of trying to squeeze that one source for everything you can, why not look at some of the dozens of other bodies of evidence that have not been examined in anything like that level of detail? Why not look at the corpus of cuneiform texts, try to dig into that? Or I did a lot of work on letters or receipts. Receipts tell you a great deal about the world, you know, that kind of stuff.
I mean, I, you know, the more people who can do cuneiform, the more of these we can read. So I hope people will be more interested in this part of the world and these sources, and will, you know, help bring them to light, really, and revive them.
Well, you have sold me on cuneiform. Dr. Moody Al-Rashid, where can people find you? Where can they follow your work?
The best place is Twitter, and just my first name, Moudhy, is my handle. So please do join. I share a lot of stuff about cuneiform, and some of it very random.
Random is good. Random is, our lives are random, you know?
Very true.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with you about this.
You too. Thank you so much, and thank you for such interesting questions.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.